Why don't we start the next component here, and we've also rejiggered this component. As part of my talk, I've also invited Reuben Shaw, another colleague at the Salk, who recently joined us, who has a new oncogene that may be relevant to pancreatic cancer, but is also relevant to the theme I'm going to use about metabolism and growth control in cancer, to fill in about 10 minutes or so. Although I know in the scientific world, saying to fill in for 10 minutes or give a brief talk is tricky to do. The shortest talk I gave was at a Gordon conference when Wally Gilbert allowed me. He said, okay, I'm going to let you talk. You have one slide and 1 minute. That was the shortest talk I gave. And he was tough. He timed it, and he was like looking at his watch the whole time. But we're giving Reuben a little bit more time than that. So Inder declared that he was the least knowledgeable in pancreatic cancer, and I'm going to declare that if he had the gold medal, I'm going to have the platinum status in pancreatic cancer, because I really don't work on it at all. But I'm very interested by the meeting and some of the themes and some of the components. And Inder, like I, had our arms severely twisted by Bill Isaacoff, who like I said we didn't want to do it. He says, that's okay, you're going to do it. And I said, but we don't know anything about pancreatic cancer. That's okay. He says, you know, neither does anyone in the field, so you're just as good. So, and it was kind of based on that theme, that bringing in people from one side of an area, particularly clinical and academic sides of pancreatic cancer, and then people who are not involved but bring some orthogonal approaches might be an interesting kind of juncture. And I've been very taken by some of the discussion. In fact, I changed my, maybe for better or for worse, my presentation to deal with some comments. So what I'm going to talk about is my favorite subject, which is nuclear hormone receptors. And these are sort of the molecular genetic switches in the genome that control a lot of metabolic activity, and they're also the target of many types of therapeutic drugs. And nuclear receptors are prototypic regulators of not just metabolism, but also inflammation. And that was that's the title that I have in the program. This title up here is metabolic engineering, and I'm going to talk a little bit about how you can use receptors to alter the metabolism of cells. And I remind you that cancer cells often shift their metabolism because all cells need energy to grow, and this is particularly true for cancer cells. If you don't get the energy, you're not going to survive. And if you're in an anaerobic environment, you have to have anaerobic metabolism or glycolytic metabolism as opposed to aerobic. And these are very key components of how cells survive. And there's a Warburg concept where cancer cells become glycolytic. And that metabolic switching is something that I'm interested in general in the body. Subtext of this is also the dawn of synthetic physiology. And one of the general, my general interest is what physiology is. And we're interested in the origin of physiology. And physiology as a medical term expresses a distributed process, but it doesn't really express a mechanistic concept. And of course, every system has to evolve through the genome, and therefore it has to have a mechanistic construction to it. And the word doesn't express a mechanism, but we're interested in whether there is a specific structure or rules to a physiologic system, and whether that dictates how the system evolved, how different physiologic systems evolve from each other, and whether that relates to the integration of physiologic response. And if you understand it, you, in theory, should be able to do what nature did, was not to knock out a physiologic system, but to actually create a physiologic system. And that's what I call synthetic physiology, which is what we're doing. We're also interested in synthetic oncology, which is creating oncogenes based on certain principles. And I think that some of these ideas could be useful. Because of the recent discussion, I've added some new slides. So I'm going to skip some of my general intros, except to say that the context of the work that we do, besides the sort of probing academic side, relates to metabolic disease. And metabolic disease is an obesity-related syndrome that has an underlying chronic inflammation associated with hyperlipidemia. It's associated with hypertension. It's associated with cardiovascular disease, and it's associated with insulin resistance and diabetes. And a metabolic disease in aggregate is the biggest medical toll on our health dollar. And it's a very intractable problem itself. As much as we know about metabolism and weight, it's hard to control. And so it's like a little bit like pancreatic cancer. As much as you know about it, it's still that doesn't mean that you can treat it. But we're interested in using the nuclear receptors as tools to probe this disease, to bring some therapeutic insight, and also to spill over in what we think is linked to other diseases, including cancer. Linked to metabolic syndrome is a much increased risk for death of all causes, and particularly death by cancer. Unfortunately, I'm going to skip. I have some animal pictures in there of a trip that we took. I'm going to skip these with Inder simply go to the background for my talk, which is the nuclear hormone receptors. There are 48 of these hormone encoding receptor genes in our genome. The ones that you most know are the steroid receptors, which are here, and we've talked about some of these. Then there are the orphan receptors in the green box. These are receptors that were isolated without known ligands. And if you find a ligand for these orphan receptors, you can de-orphanize them, and then they become adopted orphans. And that's what I'm mostly going to talk about. We're interested in the adopted orphans. But as a component of the endocrine natural hormonal receptors, in addition to steroids, there are the vitamin A receptors, thyroid hormone receptors, and vitamin D receptors. And Neil had mentioned about an aspect of stellate cells, and I'm interested in stellate cells in the liver. The stellate cells are the cells that store basically all of the vitamin A, which is mostly stored in the liver, and vitamin D. And the origin of pancreatic of biliary and hepatic cirrhosis. When cirrhosis is liver cirrhosis is a big problem. Is alcohol, and alcohol causes a direct action on the stellate cell, which causes that cell to release basically its content of vitamin A and vitamin D. And when it does that, that cell becomes activated, and it becomes a fibrotic-producing cell. And that cell basically leads to all of liver fibrosis and cirrhosis is a major generator of a lot of liver problems. And you can mimic this disease by ligating the bile duct. And bile duct ligation, someone had mentioned, what about pancreatic duct ligation? And I was struck a little bit last night, and we touched on this in our table discussion, of that the bile duct and the pancreatic duct are linked. They're physically and anatomically related to each other. And that led to a speculation of that the ducts. And I was interested in a comment that Michael Carradine made about why are some cancers so resistant to treatment, and pancreatic cancer obviously is one of those, and whether there's a mechanistic basis for that, or is that just an observation and we just don't know enough? And we can't answer that, obviously, I don't think. But in terms of ductal sources of cells, the ducts, the bile duct, and probably the pancreatic duct itself, has to be composed of cells that are super resistant to compounds and enzymes that are highly degradative in their nature and that are highly toxic and are designed to destroy other cells and digest things. So the cells, the ducts that traffic all these nasty juices themselves have to be very resistant to toxins and other components. And so one idea maybe, and this is strictly based on zero knowledge, I mean really zero knowledge, is that some of the refractory nature of the cancer could be related to the nature of the cells of origin, which have to be inherently have capacity to be very resistant to all sorts of things that are thrown at them because they're exposed to the nastiest environments of the body. Okay, so end of speculation on that. And there might be a link between the hepatic stellate cell and alcoholism and the pancreatic stellate cell and alcoholism, because alcoholism is the trigger on that cell for fibrosis. Okay. Most of my talk is going to be related to these adopted orphan receptors, and in specific, I'm going to talk about the PPRs, and in specific, I'm going to talk about one receptor called PPAR-delta, and that's the PPRs are professional regulators of fatty acid metabolism, the trafficking of fatty acids, the synthesis of fatty acids, and the burning of fatty acids. And we're very interested in looking at these receptors. An important context to the powerful metabolic regulation of these receptors and other receptors in the boxes here, such as the glucocorticoid receptor, is that the most powerful metabolic regulators are also the most powerful anti-inflammatory molecules that we know of. And so glucocorticoids, which mobilize huge amounts of sugar in the body, medically and clinically are basically never used to mobilize sugar. They're almost only used as anti-inflammatories. And nature chose that the pathways that upregulate energy generation and energy homeostasis, particularly in a survival mode where you need to burn a lot of energy to either attack a predator or to survive an attack and defend yourself, that you have to suppress inflammation, powerfully suppress inflammation when you mobilize energy. It's probably a survival mode. So the glucocorticoid receptor is a potent anti-inflammatory, and that's sort of the gold standard in inflammation suppression. The PPRs, potent anti-inflammatories, and I'll show you some of that, powerful metabolic regulators. The LXRs, liver X receptors, these traffic oxidized cholesterol or oxysterols, potent anti-inflammatories. The bile acid receptor, potent anti-inflammatory, and I won't keep going through the list because it's a little bit gets tiresome. But the point is, there's a mechanistic link between inflammation and metabolism, and to ignore that concept is to ignore something that nature went to a lot of trouble over many millions of years to link. And so I think that that's nothing else an important theme people should keep in mind. And I'm going backwards now, backwards in time. I threw in these slides, I'm going to skip them. I mentioned the important point about bile acid and bile acid trafficking may be related in its own way to the pancreatitis concept. And cirrhosis of the liver involves a disruption of bile flow. And that is a very toxic process. If you let bile move more slowly through the liver, you will get all sorts of hepatic problems. And we study that looking at the bile acid receptor, which is known as FXR. And I'm not going to go into the details of this. I think there isn't time to look at that, but there is a parallel here that might be worth considering what those parallels could be. And so now I'm just scrolling through this. And I don't know why this is not going better. Okay, I just have to keep hitting the... There we go. Okay. Right here. No, right here. All right, so this is where I'm going to dwell for the remainder of the talk, is on the PPARs. Now, these are fatty acid regulators. They occur in three forms, the alpha, gamma, and delta genes, three separate genes. Alpha is principally expressed in liver and muscle, though in other tissues, and it is the target of the fibrate class of drugs, which are used to lower triglyceride levels. PPAR gamma is the target of Actos and Avandia, which have been in the news quite a bit. These are a mechanistically unique class of insulin sensitizers. By activating this receptor, the receptor causes cells that express it to suck up fatty acids, principally adipose tissue and muscle, and it clears fatty acids out of the blood. That is a net insulin sensitizing effect. And while it leads to a little bit of weight gain, it leads to a great clearing out of triglycerides and fatty acids from the blood, and you're much more sensitive to insulin. And it's a net beneficial feature, but it's an interesting target. It's a multi-billion-dollar market, We've studied this for a long time. It's required to form adipose tissue. It's a master regulator in fat. It's expressed in other tissues where it allows trafficking of lipids into the tissue. The third member of the family is PPAR delta. There are no prescription drugs for this receptor. We think there should be. We think it's probably the best of the family, but there's a lot of worries based on these two, whether anything with that name should be allowed to be a therapeutic target. This is involved in fatty acid burning. So this promotes storage. This is sort of unlocks the battery of energy that's stored in different cells and allows you to burn it. So together they create what we call the fat balance, in which energy in gets stored, and stored energy then gets burned. And there's a fairly good regulation of this system as long as you can stay within a range. And if you take in less energy, for example, if you diet or voluntarily starve yourself, you will slow down your metabolism. You will burn less. If you take in more energy, you will increase your metabolism and burn more. Metabolic shifting is automatic in the body unless you get too much storage of energy. If you get to a certain point, you can no longer upregulate to compensate for that, and you'll get net weight gain. And ultimately, you'll get into metabolic syndrome because you cannot sufficiently upregulate the burning component to balance the system. And with drugs, however, you can shift, you can pharmacologically shift this into a synthetic range that improves important aspects of body physiology. And I also just note in here that tumor cells have to manage their own energy requirements, particularly in bad environmental niches. And therefore, modulation of how they get their energy sources, whether it's sugar, which is anaerobic, or fats, which requires aerobic metabolism, is a very key feature that they have to negotiate. Now, I want to mention in the context of the theme that I sort of laid out, the inflammatory component of the system, and I call this heartburn. And you can think of this inflammation in other cell types. We're going to talk about it in the heart, where PPAR delta extinguishes inflammation and is cardioprotective. Why is it cardioprotective? Because heart disease, especially in a hyperlipidemic situation, aggravated by genetics and poor exercise, leads to progressive coronary artery disease. Everyone in the room has coronary artery disease. It universally begins in childhood. It can actually begin in fetal life if your mother is on a very high-fat diet. And it involves the invasion of inflammatory macrophages. These macrophages clear up oxidized cholesterol that is produced locally within the arteries because arteries are under a lot of mechanical stress and there's a lot of damage that's always being repaired. And that creates local inflammation. These cells enter in to the intima of the artery and create the atherosclerotic plaque. The macrophages accumulate lipid, the so-called bad lipids, oxidized cholesterol, and reconvert it to good lipid, which is HDL. But they're inefficient at doing that, and so they wind up staying there basically your whole life if you eat a Western diet. And they build up and create an atheroma that can be occlusive and lead to heart attacks and infarcts. And half the people in the room will die from that, this unfortunate process. It has a lot of molecular markers for each one of these stages for what's going on here. And we study these molecular markers. And you can see some of these markers that you can traffic from the invasion to foam cell formation, to inflammation. You get a gruel here of cells that migrate in smooth muscle cells, lymphocytes, the macrophages, fibroblasts. It sounds familiar, and that is a nasty mix that keeps percolating for a long time and can lead to all sorts of problems, ultimately plaque rupture, heart attack, a lot of metalloproteinases expressed in that lesion. And unfortunately, it goes on for a long time. In that lesion is the activation quite robustly of an inflammatory response. I won't go through the mechanistic details of what is happening, but we've shown that PPAR delta besides stimulating metabolic activity, is able to suppress inflammation. Ligands for Delta are able to suppress inflammation. And the way they suppress inflammation is by inhibiting a pro-inflammatory regulator, which is NF-kappa-B, a molecule that, in fact, India and I have worked on together for parts of our career, and that Michael Caron currently is working on, and is actually probably will mention some work on this. This NF-kappa-B pathway is routinely activated in inflammation, so wherever this is happening, there's a general message here. I just want to say, one of the things that we did is to create a mouse model of heart disease and then give the mice a high-fat diet plus or minus a PPAR-delta investigational drug. And without going through a lot of the details of what was done here, this shows the area that's involved in the atherosclerotic lesion. And this is a hypertensive, high-fat diet model, just like human heart disease. And this is the control. This is what happens on a high-fat, hypertensive diet. If you give a PPAR-delta drug, there's a tremendous suppression of lesion development. And this is one thing we're very excited about. This is about as good as it gets for any kind of drug in suppressing heart disease in the mouse model. We're very excited by it. When we looked at the target genes, we thought they would be metabolic because it's a hyperlipidemic animal. It's an APO. This is an LDL receptor null mouse, but it's a very hyperlipidemic mouse. When we looked at the genes that were being controlled, and I won't go again through all this, Delta was suppressing chronic inflammation within that artery. The protection was coming from suppression of inflammation as opposed to altering the trafficking or changing the burning of lipids. And so in this atherogenic inflammatory environment, this drug was highly protective and was protective by using one of its modes of action, which is as a potent anti-inflammatory. And this is relevant because in a study which I'm skipping, we show equally as powerful is the action of this drug in promoting fat burning. And mice, when they're put on this drug, basically will not gain weight when placed on a high-fat diet. And the reason is that they increase oxidative metabolism, and the increase in oxidative metabolism prevents weight gain. They basically lose the extra calories by radiating out as heat. And that led us to the concept that you can use metabolic engineering as a weight loss or weight protection approach without changing diet, because changing diet is the hardest thing. If you tell people voluntarily to restrict their food intake or to go on a special diet, everyone will lose weight for a short time, but within a year, less than 3 or 4% of people will actually have lost weight. And so that means that we need other approaches that don't involve changing appetite, because that's very hard to change. That's part of our survival. But we think that increasing metabolic activity allows you to have your normal appetite, but to retain fewer calories because you shed them as heat. Joey Lewis said, I went on a diet, swore off drinking and heavy eating, and in 14 days, I lost 2 weeks. Think about that when you go to the museum tonight. It's very hard to lose weight voluntarily. You just can't do it. But we think that this provides an approach that may be accommodating to the realities of the world. And so I'm going to end with the last part of the talk about the action of this pathway in muscle. And the only thing that is relevant here, and this is the area of creating or enhancing physiology. And we wanted to increase aerobic metabolism in muscle. And some of you just saw the Tour de France. And there are two kinds of racers in the Tour. There are the speed racers, and then there are the endurance guys that can just ride for 5 hours up the Alps. And they're non-fatiguing athletes, basically. And to have non-fatiguing muscle is so-called type 1 muscle. Fatiguing but power and speed muscle is type 2 muscle. This muscle in runners and cyclists burns sugar. It's basically anaerobic. This muscle, which does not fatigue, burns fat. And for example, the diaphragm is a non-fatiguing muscle. The heart is a non-fatiguing muscle. And you have plenty of non-fatiguing muscle in our major muscle groups, but we don't use that unless you're a jogger or something. Whereas this is the survival muscle. It doesn't matter, who you are, what your weight is. If you have to move quickly, you can get out of a room. Anyone can move instantaneously. You see a lot of athletes that seem to be overweight, especially in baseball, but they're fast, but they don't have endurance. And so there's the type 1 and type 2. We engineered muscle in mice by overexpressing PPAR delta in the muscle groups. And the result was that we got something that we call a fiber type switch, which shifted the ratio, the genetic ratio, from glycolytic to more oxidative or theoretically non-fatiguing muscle. And that's shown by this increased reddish color, which is the slow twitch, myosin-rich, mitochondrial-rich fibers that burn fat. Now, why is this interesting? Well, it's interesting for us because, first of all, endurance has never been engineered in any animal. Only power has been engineered with anabolic steroids and related kinds of programs, but that never acts on endurance, and it wasn't clear why. And it wasn't clear whether it could be engineered. And so we didn't know if the fibers here would be functional, whether they would be wired to the right motor neurons, and whether they would work. And so we actually wanted to test these mice that we engineered, and we put them on a mouse treadmill. And we ran the engineered mice against the normal mice. And this is the Smarty Jones experiment. This slide was on ESPN Sports Center. They were very fascinated by this particular thing. And as a result, I got a lot of calls from athletes and coaches wanting the drug no matter what. Threatened the family, I had to move, I had to get a whole new... No, I'm just kidding about that part. Anyway, this is the engineered mouse, this is the control mouse. And we didn't know who was going to run further, if they would be identical or not. And so we put them on this treadmill. They've never run before in a continuous run. And this is now an hour and a half later. This is the control mouse. This mouse is going to run for another hour without stopping, the engineered mouse. And so this managed to engineer endurance on the first run by more than an hour. And that, why is that important? Well, it has a lot of different implications. But one thing that it proves, and I'm sure I'm going to get people coming up afterwards who want the drug now, is that that endurance can be engineered. And that means, and we engineered it by engineering metabolism in this case. And by changing the metabolic program, we actually shifted the developmental program of the cell. And by changing that, the animal inherently becomes a permanent genetic strain of mice with endurance. And we know that this, in this case, it's a metabolic program because we looked at all the target genes. They're all mitochondrial genes. They're all genes that are involved in trafficking lipids, burning lipids. Remember, cancer cells are principally glycolytic. This program shifts cells to be principally oxidative and lipid burning. And so we're interested in whether we can use this in provocative ways to shift metabolism. Now, there is a drug, and I'll just mention it briefly. The drug is different than the transgene. And the question is, in an adult mouse, could you just give a drug instead of having this gene on all the time, a drug? And would the drug allow the animal to run longer? And so this is the experiment that we did. We gave one set of mice. Of course, this is a La Jolla experiment here, so we had to design the Barca Lounger for the mice. One set of mice gets the drug, and the other gets Diet Coke. Someone asked me, do you really give them Diet Coke? And I said, obviously, that's just a joke. We don't give them Diet Coke. That's just the control mouse. And the net result of this was a surprise. And the surprise was that if you give them the drug or not, they do not run any longer, and they don't run any farther, as opposed to the experiment I just showed you. So the only thing that we proved in this experiment is that this drug induces depression in a postdoc, because that was really a bummer experiment for the postdoc that did this. And he's really good. Then that's when the PI is a psychiatrist. And you have to say, this is really a good result, you know. And it's the unexpected result that's really the important result. And could you please leave now? I don't want to tell you the answer. Figure it out. And so we did that, actually. And there's an I'll just briefly tell you the secret to getting this thing to work, and it does work. And the secret is that in adults, if you're born with a fiber ratio, that's one thing. But if you want to change it as an adult, there's one thing that you can do. And if I put you on a treadmill and run you every day like the mouse, you will increase your endurance, no matter what. Everyone will. So we decided to run these mice and change the experiment and give them the drug or not in the presence of running. And here's the happy guy. We give them a mild interval training, which is like 60 to 65% of their capacity. So they never run to exhaustion. Mild training in the presence of the drug or not. And the bottom line of the experiment, and then we do the treadmill study. And I'm just going to show you the bottom line is here. In the context of mild exercise, the drug suddenly gives you another hour of endurance after you've run. Relative to the mice who are trained, who also improve, but not as much as if you're on the drug. And this is also the distance run. You can see it's more than a kilometer additional distance in the first exhaustive run from these mice. And when we looked at the target genes that were responsible for this, I'm just going to skip ahead on some slides. We found three interesting sets of genes. One set of genes is induced by the drug, and this would probably happen in many cells in the body, including cancer cells. And that these are the drug-induced genes in this square, about 100 genes. Then we ask, what are the genes that are induced just when you run the mice by exercise? And in fact, a bunch of genes get induced by exercise. And these are the genes induced by exercise. And if you see, the drug, without exercise, phenocopies exercise by about half. So about half the genes that exercise induces, the drug induces. But it doesn't do everything, because I show you the drug alone didn't allow these mice to run any further. Then if you exercise them and give the drug, you might expect to get the combined circles. But what you get is a third circle, where some genes don't get expressed, new genes, a whole set of 50 genes get expressed. This we call the endurance gene signature. And something happens when you exercise that allows the drug to have a different activity, and that's the key thing. And I just want to basically end here by saying exercise, the mechanical process of exercise, does one thing. It's very simple. It burns ATP. That's what generates heat. And when you burn ATP, you create more ADP and AMP. And when you generate more AMP, you activate a certain set of pathways such as AMP kinase. And I'm not going to go through a lot of the logic here because we don't have time, but in fact, Ruben Shaw is going to talk about this. AMP kinase is a central regulator of energy homeostasis. And it makes sense that when you exercise and activate through exercise the pathways that you need to activate that alter the energy status of the mice, in the context of PPR delta, that combination leads to a powerful synergism. And that synergism leads to what we think is this synthetic response that I showed you. And I'm not going to go through all that, except I think I'm just going to end here. Thank principally the person that did this work, Yang-Xu Wang, started some of this work. He left now on these endurance mice, and this is a pun, but he's running his own lab now at UMass, and that's now being carried on. In my lab, it's being carried on by Vihang Narkar and several other postdoctoral fellows in the group. And that's probably all I really need to say. I should say that the inflammatory studies in the heart were done by Grant Barish and Chi-Hao Li, who's now at Harvard. He has his own lab. And these guys are terrific. And Inder's going to talk about what's here in the background a little bit later. But I'm going to turn this over now to Ruben Shaw.
Okay, I'd like to thank Ron for suggesting that I tell you guys a little bit about what my lab at the Salk does. So I know a number of you in the audience. I was a graduate student with Tyler Jackson, overlapped with both Dave Tuveson and Sunil, and subsequently went and did my postdoc at Harvard Medical School with Lou Cantley, where I began the work that I now work on my own lab that I'll tell you about in a minute. And there I collaborated extensively with people in Ron DiPinno's lab, particularly Nabil Bardizi, who's here, as well as Aram, who's also here. So my work really began at that time when I was leaving Tyler's lab. A new tumor suppressor gene was identified, and I thought it was particularly intriguing, and thought I knew that I wanted to go off and study it for my postdoc. And the reason it was intriguing was because it was loss of function of a serine threonine kinase. And the kinase was dumped into the database under the acronym LKB1. This is the gene responsible for an inherited cancer disorder called Peutz-Jeghers syndrome. These patients develop gastrointestinal polyps with 100% penetrance. Like a number of other inherited familial cancer diseases, they are also predisposed to early onset tumors in a number of other tissues. Interestingly, LKB1 mutations happen to be quite common in sporadic lung adenocarcinoma. In fact, as much as 30-40% of some subtypes of sporadic lung adenocarcinoma show LKB1 mutations. So in terms of the general population, this is in fact the most prevalent source of LKB1 mutations. Intriguingly, in that disease, LKB1 mutations co-segregate with KRAS, which is even more interesting to this crowd because, in addition, there are actually a small but significant subset of pancreatic cancers that have also shown inactivating mutations in LKB1. Given that KRAS is one of the best known mutations in pancreatic cancer, I think delineating the relationship between LKB1 and KRAS in pancreatic cancer as compared to LKB1 and KRAS in lung cancer, which has been further studied significantly, in fact, by Nabil and a number of collaborators. And I'll leave that to him to tell you about over drinks later tonight, maybe. But I think this is a potential area of interest for pancreatic cancer. Now, I won't dwell on this, but during my time as a postdoc in the Cantley lab, I identified a key substrate of LKB1 as being the AMP kinase, so the AMP activated protein kinase. It turns out LKB1 is the long sought after upstream activating kinase for AMPK, and it directly phosphorylates the activation loop of AMP kinase. And as Ron just alluded to, AMP kinase is unique and highly studied in the metabolic and diabetes field because it serves as a central organizer of all metabolism, both on a cellular and organismal level. So a number of adipokines, such as leptin and adiponectin, as well as exercise, we just heard, all feed into the activation of AMP kinase. And all of the AMP-dependent activation of AMPK relies on LKB1. So there's a single gene in mammals, this gene LKB1, which also happens to be inactivated in cancers, that is responsible for activating AMPK. So this unexpected connection between a tumor suppressor gene and this central metabolic switch really led to two immediate questions. First of all, would it be that AMP kinase has anything to do with cancer, or would it be that LKB1 regulates, 20 things? AMPK is one of them, but it has nothing to do with the cancer phenotype. Conversely, would LKB1 turn out to be the critical upstream regulator of AMPK, so important for the suppression of diabetes? And obviously, I don't have time to go through all this, and much of this is published, so I'll start with the second question first. Does LKB1 have anything to do with metabolic control in key tissues in mammals? So I made a liver-specific knockout of LKB1 using a mice that we made in collaboration with Nabil and Ron. And in those animals, there's a very rapid and immediate, very dramatic doubling of fasting blood glucose, which continues to skyrocket. And so there is a extreme hyperglycemia and hyperlipidemia in these mice. I then went on to show that, in fact, LKB1 and the activation of AMP kinase are the key or amongst the key targets of the drug metformin, which is the most widely prescribed diabetes therapeutic in the world. It's marketed in the States under the name Glucophage. It is estimated that 100 million people in the world have taken this drug for some amount of time or another. And here, just using these liver-specific knockouts, we showed that, in fact, you need this pathway to be intact in liver for the therapeutic effect of this drug here in suppressing increased blood glucose. So wild-type animals, if you put them on a metformin regimen, you lower blood glucose. LKB1 liver knockouts has no effect. What's so striking about this single gene, this one kinase LKB1, is that I just showed you just now that if you delete it in liver, you get this type 2 diabetes-like metabolic syndrome. However, if you delete it in other tissues, you get tumors. So in LKB1 heterozygous mice, which mimic genetically the Poitiers patients, they in fact are predisposed to gastrointestinal polyps, again with 100% penetrance. So this is actually an excellent model of Poitiers syndrome, and in fact this is work from Nabil, who's here in the crowd. This is from his Nature paper in 2002. So the question I wanted to know was, does AMP kinase have anything to do with the tumor suppressor aspect? I showed you that LKB1 regulates metabolism. Does AMPK have anything to do with, frankly, with cancer? And amongst the different things that AMPK was known to do, there was one that I found particularly interesting, and that is that it was known to regulate protein synthesis. And the reason I found that intriguing was for a reason that I omitted telling you on the previous slide, which is that clinically, loss of LKB1 looks very similar to loss of P10. And this pathway, which has been discussed many times, the PI3 kinase signaling pathway, is known to be the critical pathway negatively regulated by P10. And one of the key downstream effectors is this complex we've heard about several times, the mTOR complex. mTOR is positively regulated by nutrients across all eukaryotes. Interestingly, AMP kinase has the inverse relationship across all eukaryotes. So I wondered if perhaps these diseases could be biochemically linked through a common effector of these different tumor suppressors all serving to negatively regulate that complex. So I turned back to a proteomic and bioinformatic technique that I had used in the Cantley lab to identify potential substrates of AMP kinase. And I don't have time to tell you this, obviously, but suffice to say, when I was a postdoc in Cantley's lab, I identified the TSC2 tumor suppressor as a substrate. More recently in my own lab, I've gone on to show that, in fact, the mTOR subunit RAPTOR is, in fact, a direct substrate of AMPK, both in vitro and in vivo. And finally, I guess maybe Ron pulled a few more slides, but suffice to say, which is probably a good idea, but I lose my transitions then. Mitogens and nutrients are really converging to regulate this complex. So both growth factors and nutrients converge to control, almost in a rheostat fashion, certainly a synergistic combinatorial fashion, this mTOR complex. And so I think a key question will be how modulators of this complex will sensitize different classes of tumors. And certainly it will not work for many classes of tumors. And I think, I don't need to belabor this point, Neil, I think, really eloquently spoke to these kinds of issues yesterday. Finally, let me just sum up by saying that we think that LKB1, through its activation of AMPK, is really simply a metabolic checkpoint. This is no different than the DNA damage checkpoint or than the mitotic checkpoint. In this case, it senses damage. The damage in this case is a loss of ATP, and then it serves to correct that loss by upregulating mitochondrial function, as we just heard from Ron, as well as by stimulating glycolysis. In the absence of the sensor, you create damage, and I don't have time to show you this, but cells mutated in several of these substrates, as well as in LKB and AMPK itself by genetic knockouts, all show increased proliferation under conditions of low glucose or of energy stress. So that also begs the question, could some of these AMP kinase agonists, some of which are in fact widely used diabetes therapeutics, be used to alter cell growth? in the context of pancreatic cancer, what is loss of LKB1 conferring? And is there a co-segregation of LKB1 mutations with KRAS as there is in the lung adenocarcinomas? And in fact, if there is in fact part of this selection for LKB1 loss in pancreatic cancer, would that confer a higher sensitivity of tumors, pancreatic tumors that lack LKB1, onto responding to rapamycin analogs? And I just want to just reinforce what Neil was saying yesterday. I think the key is not just what one mutation, not just whether or not pancreatic cancers have a KRAS mutation, but what the other combination of mutations are, which genes are still wild type that are upstream and downstream, and that is, it's going to be the combination that dictates whether or not therapeutics that are targeted will work. Let me just sum up by saying, I think that this pathway provides an interesting possibility for representing a long-known phenomena that both diet and exercise have dominant effects on cancer rates and cancer risks, and perhaps now we know that excess nutrients will serve to inhibit AMPK and stimulate TOR. This, in fact, this very simple pathway from LKB to AMPK suppressing TOR could be part of the explanation. We also know that exercise as well as metformin increase AMPK and shut off TOR in peripheral tissues. So let me just conclude then. By saying much of this work was done while I was in Lou Cantley's lab as a postdoc. I collaborated extensively with Nabil and Ron, and now with the Saul collaborate with a number of people, including Mark Montminy and Ron Evans, and this is my lab, and I think many of you, I don't know if you're actually going to go to the Salk or not, but my lab is right here, right on the side of the courtyard when you're facing the ocean. So thank you.
Does anybody have a question for Ron or Ruben while we're waiting for the... Neil, actually, is there a microphone available?
No, it has to go.
Why don't you just speak at my chest?
Okay. What's the co-activator in pancreas?
No.
What's for this? I think that's an excellent point, and I think I can only speculate what it might be in pancreas. I do think... You know, analogous to RAS activating PI3 kinase, and so, you know, people might make the argument, well, why would you need both, or why would you need AKT and, you know, additional inputs through the pathway? I think has to be synergy on downstream targets. So PI3 kinase pushing to mTOR will do some things. Loss of LKB1 and increase of AMPK will further push on the mTOR complex, and then in addition to getting a synergistic push on the mTORC1 complex, each of them will also hit unique things that further drive the overall biology, such as you've pointed out and in some of your work with translation and some of the work synergizing on other targets like BAD and some of the other things. We don't know what the targets are, what the molecules are, but I very firmly believe it will be analogous, that there will be a common set of effectors that are pushed by the dual mutation and then unique substrates that kind of round out the biological response.
Okay, so thanks. Michael?
Well, not only that I read Ron's mind, but I actually had no idea about Ruben's talk. So I actually am a clairvoyant as well. Because what I wanted to point out that the most common pathway activating human cancer, the PI3 kinase mTOR pathway, is also a major regulator of metabolism. Obesity causes insulin resistance and increases cancer risk. And one question that I think is important to discuss is that due to chronic low level of inflammation, something that does happen as a consequence of obesity, and I'll show an example for that, or long-term suppression of mTOR. And we heard yesterday from Tony Hunter about all those unexpected feedback loops that even though when you suppress mTOR, you may actually end up getting the opposite results. And there's a lot of ways to actually test these, so I think one should not jump to interpretation of different knockouts and transgenic data until more complex experiments are actually being done. I'd like to show, I mean, Ron talked a lot about obesity. We definitely are dealing now with an obesity epidemic. Obesity can certainly lead to macrophage recruitment and activation within adipose tissue. Every organ, the liver, the pancreas, does have some adipose tissue within it, and that can affect not only inflammation within the adipose tissue, but also within other cells within that organ. And I can show you examples that adiposity and obesity definitely lead to production of tumor-promoting cytokines, such as IL-6 and TNF-alpha. And the question is, what is the actual impact on cancer risk and tumor progression? And we need to address this both by epidemiological studies in human beings as well as model studies in mice. And at least the obesity cancer connection in mice is really pretty much in its infancy and hasn't been addressed yet. We've been studying both inflammation and cancer, but also inflammation and obesity. And we identified several years ago in collaboration with Gökhan Hotamislegil at Harvard, June kinase that we've identified long time ago here in San Diego as a major inhibitor of insulin signaling through the phosphorylation of both IRS1 and IRS2. And we have shown that inhibition of JNK, either by genetic disruption of the JNK1 locus or the use of JNK inhibitors, is a major insulin sensitizer. In addition to having effect on insulin signaling, JNK1 knockout mice are lean. We still don't know the mechanism for that, and we try to identify the cell type involved. And we have constructed radiation chimeras, and this is actually MRI analysis of body mass, and all this white stuff is fat. It's quite disgusting. You can see that obese mice are mostly composed of fat. All the internal organs remain the same. When you do these radiation chimeras, we actually find that it's junk in stromal cells, non-hematopoietic cells, that is responsible for fat buildup through an unknown mechanism. But we also found that junk in hematopoietic cells, bone marrow-derived cells, is very important for obesity-induced inflammation. And one characteristic of obesity-induced inflammation is formation of these crown-like structures, which are actually aggregates of macrophages as well as dendritic cells surrounding adipocytes. And these cells are not just recruited to adipose deposits, they actually produce cytokines that we know from other studies, TNF-alpha and IL-6, that are controlled in part through junk activation that we know from other studies are tumor promoting. So this is something that is important to study in the context of pancreatic cancer or other cancer models. Now the other point I would like to address is that we know now from a variety of studies, epidemiological studies in human beings and model studies in mice, that inflammation in cancer are linked. And this goes back to something that Daphna said, that we need to distinguish between different types of inflammation. And in my mind, it's important to distinguish between inflammation that precedes and underlies tumor development and then the inflammation that is actually elicited by the cancer cells themselves. And necrotic cell death of cancer cells that don't receive enough nutrients can definitely trigger inflammation. And that inflammation is used by the tumors to promote their own malignant progression. There's a great deal of data in mice and also in men that interference with inflammation can reduce cancer risk and may be used in cancer prevention. But the real question is, can we use anti-inflammatory therapy to enhance the outcome of conventional and targeted anti-cancer therapies. So far, all the studies we have in animals show the prophylactic value of anti-inflammatory intervention, but we really need to evaluate the therapeutic value of anti-inflammatory therapy. And another point for discussion is I think that we need to pay close attention to human cancer biology and epidemiology. And Ron talked a lot about nuclear receptors, and nuclear receptors, in addition to controlling metabolism, control sex. And I want to show you one example that sex and nuclear receptors make big differences. And this is from our studies on hepatocellular carcinoma. In humans, it's known that the worldwide incidence of hepatocellular carcinoma in males is 3 to 5 times greater than in females. People have been interpreting this in different ways. They say males drink more than females, but that doesn't really explain the whole thing. Mice don't drink at all unless you make them drink. And yet, when you inject male mice with a carcinogen, diethylnitrosamine, 100% of them develop hepatocellular carcinoma. The same dose in female mice only induces cancer in about 10 to 15% of the females. So you see the same thing in mice as you see in human, and if you use rats instead of mice, you see the same gender bias. We found that this is related to, in this case, this carcinogen-induced model is related to production of interleukin-6. When you inject the males with the carcinogen, they produce a lot more IL-6 than females. You can see this both by looking at IL-6 in the circulation or measuring IL-6 mRNA in the liver. And we have shown that if you ablate IL-6, you completely abolish the gender differences in development of liver cancer. The males behave just like females. They're still males. They reproduce normally. They do what males are supposed to do, but they don't respond to the carcinogen, and most of them never develop liver cancer, the absence of one single cytokine, and yet they're exposed to an extremely potent carcinogen that in wild-type males will induce hepatocellular carcinoma in 100% of the mice. And we followed them for almost 2 years, and they remain cancer-free. We've shown that IL-6, in addition to promoting development of liver cancer, also amplified carcinogen-induced injury. Estrogen suppresses that. And I think we need to learn from this about the potential use of SERMs in cancer prevention and maybe in cancer therapy. Tony also mentioned something about STAT3 yesterday. And again, we find that males show much more STAT3 activation than females. And it's all dependent on production of IL-6 in response to carcinogen induction. And again, ER-alpha agonist can affect all of that. So after all of this, we went back to the human data and we tried to stratify it. And this is the last point I want to make. That if now we look at age effect together with gender effects on liver cancer, we find that in age groups younger than 50 years of age, men have 7 to 10 times more hepatocellular carcinoma than females. And one way to, and if you look now at older individuals, this differential only drops to only threefold. So it seems that maybe it's due to elevation of IL-6 after menopause in women, and that may accelerate the growth of hepatocellular carcinomas. We have done transplantation studies, and we know that we can induce cancer in males, transfer it to females, and it will grow very slowly in the female environment. And then, I don't know much about pancreatic cancer, but I did a lot of reading of the hepatocellular carcinoma literature. And if you look now at all the risk factors for liver cancer, they are quite different from each other, but they have one common denominator. They all cause liver injury and oxidative stress. And the question is whether risk factor for pancreatic cancer act through similar common mechanism.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. That was fascinating. Could you tell us if this difference in IL-6 levels in rats and mice are similar in humans?
Well, we need to look. So the problem is there's IL-6 data in people with hepatocellular carcinoma. It's quite high comparison to liver to normal individuals. But we really need to see what happens in early stages of liver disease before you have cirrhotic liver and so on. And we couldn't find any data in the literature.
Independent
of liver
disease.
The other thing is we could
not
find, when we found data, we could not find the gender of the individuals.
So independent of liver disease, is it true that IL-6 levels in women raise at menopause? Raised at menopause?
Yeah, so one theory is that estrogen suppression of IL-6 is the major way by which estrogen protects you and all other women in this room from osteoporosis. And it's the postmenopausal increase in IL-6 which drives osteoclast differentiation, which is responsible for the increased risk of osteoporosis after menopause, and that's how CIRMs would prevent osteoporosis through the suppression of IL-6 production.
Can we get a mic down here as well, please? And then...
Is there any evidence?
Is there any evidence that it switched on? No. There we go.
Is there any evidence of variation in IL-6 by race? Because one of the questions that I've had that hasn't been adequately answered is that in this country, African-American men have 50% higher rates of pancreatic cancer compared, for example, to white women. Now, men in general, for both races, have a higher risk of pancreatic cancer. But African-American men, in fact, have the highest rates of pancreatic cancer in this country, and it's among the highest rates of pancreatic cancer worldwide. There have been some attempts in the epidemiologic studies to try to account for some of these differences by environmental exposures. But really, those analyses, they're very hard. They're very few and far between. The data are very thin. And the explanations thus far really haven't been adequate. So it doesn't appear to be completely accounted for by, for example, differences in rates of smoking or differences in rates of diabetes, which in and of itself wouldn't even account for that.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very important point, but you really need quite a lot of epidemiological studies. We also work on prostate cancer, and there was an earlier hypothesis. Also, African Americans have much more prostate cancers than Asian Americans. African Americans have much higher levels of testosterone than Asian Americans, and it was thought that maybe it's the high level of testosterone. But then when they go back to Africa, then rates of prostate cancer are extremely low. And now the explanation of all of this, at least for prostate cancer, is that it's due to dietary factors. And in Africa, they eat a lot less red meat than in the U.S. So it's probably a combination of hormonal factors plus dietary factors, environmental factors, and so on. So we need to look at all these different racial groups in other countries and other continents and look at cancer risks in other countries where, unfortunately, sometimes the data is not available.
Neil, you had a point.
This is a technical question that David told me was a dumb question an hour and a half ago, and it probably still is. But to you and Mariano and anybody else who wants to weigh in, tamoxifen-induced oncogenes and the phenotype we see in animals, how much of that is the lack of penetrance of the gene versus the effect of tamoxifen? And particularly, which nuclear receptors does tamoxifen bind to in mouse liver? ER alpha, ER beta, anything else?
Yeah, so we actually figure out that in our case, the effects of estrogen are all mediated through ER alpha. It's totally independent of ER beta. We use tamoxifen because we are trying to find estrogens that can be given to men because men are at a much higher risk of liver cancer than females. So we thought naively that tamoxifen would be good, but turns out tamoxifen made everything worse, and tamoxifen augmented IL-6 production in Kupffer cells. And then we went to another pure ER-alpha agonist, PPT, and that worked as well as estrogen. So it's very important to realize that tamoxifen is not some neutral molecule, that it has some big effects on physiology in all of these mouse models.
So there are three other receptors that respond to tamoxifen, however, very effectively, which are called the estrogen-related receptors, or ERRs. And they are naturally active, but they do bind tamoxifen, and tamoxifen turns them off, and they're widely expressed throughout the body. So, yeah, the murine receptors bind as well, and so tamoxifen has a probably very complicated action. It's not simply dependent on estrogen receptors; there are other targets.
Can we just do one more question, Tony? You want to do?
So I'm intrigued by the question of metabolism and metabolic stress. And I had a couple of questions about nuclear receptors for carcinogens in particular. So are there carcinogens in cigarette smoke that bind to perhaps to certain nuclear receptors that would promote carcinogenesis, or some of the mechanisms that you talked about, number one? And the second question is, the idea related to that of setting up pre-neoplastic niches where you might actually expect that some of these things may actually influence organ sites that would prepare those organ sites in a way that would be more receptive to the metastatic spread of cancer cells. And you could then extend that to factors maybe that were produced by cancer cells that would also go and influence those environments. So has there been any thought, or could you sort of speculate on that, from the point of view of this, and then, looking forward even to cachexia too, if factors from the tumor cells might actually promote, those sorts of processes as well. So it's a big global question.
There's a lot of ramble that could go into that. But the simple part of it is that that smoke from cigarettes, it has a lot of different components into it, and there are a lot of small molecules in there. Two nuclear receptors that mediate what we call xenobiotic response, that is environmental pathogens, including environmental carcinogens, are called PXR and CAR, and these xenobiotic receptors activate. They're supposed to activate the detoxification pathways that inactivate some of the toxins and carcinogens. But they not infrequently in the metabolic process create more active intermediates that are pro-carcinogenic while they're trying to neutralize the initiating chemical. And so there is a specific regulation of those receptors in lung cancer, if you're talking about lung cancer in general, but they do upregulate, oddly enough, while these principally are liver receptors, because that's the tissue that detoxifies, and also in the intestine and stomach, a lot of tumor cells will upregulate these receptors. The xenobiotic receptors principally control what are called multiple drug resistance genes, the so-called MDR pumps that cause cells to become refractory to chemotherapy. And so there are other receptors that help to create kind of very unusual specific events, ultimately that involved in chemo resistance that are trying to protect cells against toxins and carcinogens, but of course then you throw drugs at them, which you're trying to kill the cells now, and of course this system's upregulated to try to protect the cell. And so there is an idea to try to thwart those, and actually there are some drugs that are being developed to try to block these receptors so that
those cells lose their protection. Problem is that it's hard to direct it to those cells, so all the cells will lose their protection. So you get a little bit of a catch-22 there. So that's probably about a short answer. I can go into longer answers than that, but I don't think that Roger will.
No, I think, as I said, it's not a movable feast. Some very, very, very quick things. Instead of trying to do the meeting goals, the Jeff Weil handout with the three questions, we now go to lunch. And thank you, gentlemen.